Item three, a presentation from staff and Torchlight regarding potential commitment to the Torchlight Debt Opportunity Fund. Tim, you and Chi-Chi want to start?
We will start it off and then
bring in Torchlight.
Gentlemen in. Just a little background for some of the newer trustees. We have in our investment policy statement the stated goal of investing in follow-on funds, private funds from managers, provided that we still see a solid opportunity set and our confidence in the manager remains sound. So you're going to be hearing from three managers today. Torchlight's first. Torchlight invests in privately structured vehicles that acquire real estate-related debt. We treat it as kind of a hybrid of real estate and fixed income. It's actually in our fixed income program. It's our only non-traditional type of fixed income. So there was money to deploy in our budget. Torchlight has come back with a new fund. So Chi-Chi has underwritten it. I'll let him get into the details of the actual opportunity set here, and then we'll bring Torchlight in. But that's the background of how we got to this point today.
So we have a very strong fixed income program. I was looking at Milliman's quarterly report this morning, page 13. And the domestic fixed income, the ranking has been consistently ranked very high among our peers. And I think we think Torchlight is a unique and important piece of that strong performance. We committed $60 million 2 years ago in Fund 4, and right now Fund 4 is almost done with investing, but there are still market opportunities there. We talked to them, and these guys are very good at capturing different market opportunities at different investment cycles. If you turn to page 9 of the staff memo, so these are the investment of Torchlight. They invest mostly in commercial real estate debt. And this debt floating rate instrument with very high coupon. For example, you look at the Fund 1, they have most of their investment in below investment grade CMBS. But you can see that investment portion drop over the years. And then you look at the commercial real estate loan, that portion has been increasing over the investment cycles. So I will let them talk more about these different market opportunities and how they capture them. And on the allocation level, we can give them more. The level to maintain our traditional exposure with Torchlight is about $140 million. As staff, we have an internal debate on that, and we think it's prudent to reserve some capacity for future other opportunities. Not to say those opportunities are better than Torchlight, but they just have different risk exposure.
And the other side of that is we've invested with Torchlight and the predecessor firm ING Clarion since Fund 1. There's similar strategies here. There was a lesson learned in Fund 2 where we had been in Fund 1. Fund 1 got all the capital returned to us quickly while Fund 2 was still in its investment period. We elected to make an additional commitment to Fund 2. It ended up being a $128 million aggregate commitment to Fund 2. Unfortunately, Fund 2 was the lowest performing fund in our lineup. So one of the lessons learned there is we like Torchlight's people, we like the process, we like the opportunity set. However, the market conditions are unknowable in advance. And we feel it's better to maintain kind of a level allocation. And as Chi-Chi said, we're actually kind of being on the conservative side here. We don't know what opportunities are going to arise over the next 12, 18, 24 months. So we're taking some of the money that we look at when we look at our fixed income program in aggregate. More money could be deployed to privately structured vehicles. We're not going all in. We're taking some of that money and saying, you know, we want to take some of this risk on to our books with Torchlight. We don't want to take all of the possible reserves and deploy them to Torchlight. We'll see what else is out there down the road.
And with the higher coupon rate, higher return, comes another layer of risk, and for Torchlight, it's mostly in real estate. But we are very confident that these guys know as much real estate as much as they know debt. So real estate is really, they pay attention to the quality of the asset, the tenant, the location, just like our real estate equity managers. So we are comfortable that if there's anyone out there who can handle the risk, they are definitely.
Chi-Chi, I want you to just ask comment. On your memo on page 8, you describe, I think it's IRRs from inception at 5% net of their fees, 9.2 before. It doesn't appear to tie directly to page 13 of their report, which is 14.4. And I'm not 9.2 if that's, in other words, we ended up, it looks like, after we paid fees of earning 5%. And if that is comparable to 4.6, we had a net return from inception in excess of the index of 0.4. Obviously, that's better than a loss, but it's also not particularly comforting.
Yeah, that was a great comment. I was thinking about that this morning. How do I explain this? And you ask. So
that's why we have it.
The page A, you can also see the commitment amount just right on top of the combined performance. And the reason for our 5% net return is really we committed most of our money with them into their worst performing fund, which is Fund 2. And at that time, just like Tim mentioned, we had distribution back, and you know, we give them more on top of our original commitment to Fund 2. So going forward, to avoid that, we try to remain consistent with each commitment. But with the growth of our total asset size, inevitably you would have to commit more just to maintain the level. So the solution for that is to try to see other opportunities. And that's what we have been doing.
And the other part of that is the fee structure has changed from fund to fund. There's been a declining level of management fees. We've worked with Torchlight, as we've worked with all of our managers, trying to get the management fees reduced as much as possible. We really want to align the incentives, so we try to make sure that they get the bulk of their revenue, the bulk of, you know, their income on the carried interest. So they get the income when the overall fund is successful. When the overall fund is lackluster, we want the management fees as low as possible. Obviously enough to keep the team on payroll and keep the lights on, that sort of thing, but shift more of that to the carried interest side.
And Tim, so if the standard is 2 and 20, what we're working on is getting the 2 down to something lower than 2?
1.5 in this
1.5.
case.
Okay.
Yeah, and getting the carried interest, getting the hurdle level on the carried interest higher, migrated up to a higher number. I'm much more comfortable if a manager can come back and say 2 and 20 is kind of, as you put it, the standard. The hurdle rate is generally 8% for a lot of these privately structured vehicles. I would like to see that move, you know, migrate north to 9% and 10%. And Torchlight has been receptive to the suggestions over time. They've got their hurdle rate at 9%. So they have to return all of our capital, all of the management fees, and 9% annualized rate of return, and then they start to get their 20% interest in there. So it's, we get all our money back, we get kind of our locked in 9%, and then we start to share the proceeds going forward after that.
Coming back quickly to John, in my last memo 2 years ago, I did an analysis, this assumption that what if we commit the same amount in all of their funds? What happened to our return if we had done that? And the return was much, much higher. I can do that again and send it out to you if you are interested.
I don't need that. And you, by the way, in certainly fairness to your full disclosure, you did mention that in your memo. I just wanted you to comment on it because when you look at those numbers, and they are, it doesn't pick a year out, it is from inception. Mm-hmm. What your reaction was, and whether you were still comfortable going forward, and it looks like you are, and it looks like you've got
There's a lesson learned there. So, you know, we could have given them 140 this time. We decided to just stay consistent.
Oh, it was kind of the perfect storm. The first fund returned the money so quickly that we were in and out of it. So the IRR was kind of influenced by that period.
Yes.
And then fund two, the extra amount of money that we gave, it was poor performing and it lasted longer. Much longer than the first fund.
Yeah.
And it's the worst performing of the four. So it was kind of the perfect storm as far as the impact on the IRR.
I got a question. Page 10, I need something explained to me. I just don't understand it. On page 10, risk impact, future opportunities of domestic fixed income, the second to the last paragraph, the last line, can you explain that to me? It says, lower duration investment tends to do better in a rising interest rate environment. I don't know if I quite understand that concept.
Right. So in a rising interest rate environment, every new bond issuance is going to come out at a higher coupon level, a higher interest rate. In order to kind of keep everything equal between the new bond coming out, let's say the market is generally at 4% coupon. Mm-hmm. Interest rates rise to 5%. So the next person who issues has got to issue something at 5%. Well, if there's no difference between the collateral of the legacy debt and this new piece of debt that's paying a higher coupon rate, the prices of the old debt have to adjust downwards to keep everything equal. The longer duration you have, the more that's magnified. So a shorter duration doesn't have to adjust as much. You got a one-day duration, it adjusts next day. If you got a 1 year, adjust pretty quickly. If you got a 30-year, the price has got to take the full impact of that.
I get the time factor. Yep. Okay. Thank you.
So just to summarize quickly, if you turn to page 11 of the staff memo, so with the recommended commitment to Torchlight, if you look at the table at the very bottom of the page 11, this is what you will get. So it's a very balanced portfolio. The Torchlight percentage is about 15% of all our fixed income portfolio, and historically that is 20%. So even we give them 75, we are actually lower overall exposure to them just because of our asset has grown so much.
And keep in mind that Fund 2 and Fund 3 are selling assets. We're going to be returning capital over the next couple of years, so those numbers will be declining.
I've learned to ask certain questions.
Please.
Well, no, I see that you're recommending a $75 million investment, and it's a $1 billion fund?
Yep.
So where are we in the, or do we know where we are in
the hierarchy?
Order? Yeah.
We're in the upper half. I can't say how far in the upper half. They're in the early days of fundraising still. We can ask them that question.
I'm just, it's $75 million is a lot of money, but they're, if somebody else is putting in
I would expect us to be within the top five investors.
We're in the top five.
Okay. I would expect, but, let Dan answer that question.
Is there an indication of how much money they've already committed, raised on Fund 5?
They have not done a close yet.
No. So we will be in their first close.
Yeah.
Do you know how much they've raised so far?
You can ask them. Close, it's constantly in flux. So we'll get an update from them today. But until you actually make a close, it's, it's all speculation.
Okay.
Because very few investors are going to make a public statement as we are doing it. Here's our point.
Well, that's what I'm asking. Yeah. Have they had people make a public disclosure that they're
not
going
to the best of my knowledge, but it's been a couple weeks since we touched base with them on that front, so let's get the update from them.
All right.
Okay, and so a few words. So that exposure to Torchlight, I think we always like to think about it as counterbalanced by the very conservative, safe investment with AFL-CIO. These are government-backed. Fixed income, multi-family, security, Fannie Mae. And so this way we reserve 4.5% for future investment opportunities. And these are not something we just came up for this. Tim and I, we have been following the market, build up our potential investment pipeline. We have been doing that for years. So we feel like when the market opportunity comes, we do have a few candidates to think about.
Any other questions from the board? If not, we'll get Dan Heflin and Mike Romo in here.
Who's with him, Michael?
Hmm?
Who's with him?
Michael Romo.
Field quarterback.
Is that a microphone in your pocket, or are you just happy to see it in your face? Bones are fairly tasteless.
He left you alone, Mike. By yourself.
I'm sorry you so quickly agreed.
Hey, over there.
Morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm trying to be more unpredictable.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Tim and Chi-Chi have given you a great introduction, so jump right in.
Okay. Well, I appreciate that. Thank you for having us here this morning. I think everybody has a hard copy that
yes.
was shipped ahead of time.
Yep.
Super. I'm Dan Heflin. I'm the Chief Investment Officer. Actually, I founded Torchlight 18 and a half years ago. I'm here with Mike Romo, who, with Bob Copchains, runs client services for us. Bob sends his regrets. He's doing a father-daughter thing today.
Ah.
So, Mike,
Somebody's got their phone near the mic.
We're trying to figure out who that is. It's actually an iPad.
It's what?
It's an iPad.
It's an iPad.
Sure. Yeah. Mine's off.
Email alarm.
I hear a vibration, probably a phone. There's no vibrator in an iPad.
So there's nobody. I mean, mine's on silent, so I know it's not me.
Mine's off, so.
Mine's nobody's not up even there.
The mystery continues.
Sorry about that.
Do we continue?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. I'm in section one. I'll just give you a brief overview of what we're going to cover. Happy to spend as much time on any particular topic that you would like. We're here to present our firm, and we appreciate the invitation to present our latest fund. Last time we were here was presenting proposing a fund was 2.5 years ago, and we've now fully invested that fund. We think that strategy is wise in the current market, and in fact think there are very, very interesting opportunities there. So what we'll do is review the firm. Mike will cover the firm and how we're set up, and I'll cover the market and the investments we've made for you, as well as the strategy and the opportunities out there. And please feel free to ask any questions along the way.
So going on to page 8, and please feel free to ask any questions you want. I know you're very familiar with the firm, having been investors in all of the debt opportunity funds. As Dan mentioned, he's our founder and CEO. ING had a minority stake in our platform from 2002 to 2010, so we're 4 years removed from buying back the minority stake. So as of today, we're 100% owned by the management team, so everybody that sits on the operating committee or the investment committee and the marketing side, we all made investments to buy into the firm. So needless to say, there's complete alignment of interest. All of the partners make co-investments along with you in all of the funds. So needless to say, we have our eye on the ball. Over the 19 and a half year history of the firm, we've been focused exclusively on commercial real estate debt, which I think is one thing that really sets us apart. We've invested over $20 billion over that time frame. And as of today, we currently manage $4 billion of AUM. We make investments, largely on the CMBS side, but also on the private side. So we have teams that are dedicated to both. So we have a very deep bench of experienced investment people, both on the private side and the public side. In addition to that, we have a rated special servicer that oversees distressed debt workout business. And so currently we have $2 billion in REO in that business. Over the lifetime of the firm, we've grown Thanks to support with investors like you, to over 50 investors is where we sit today. Again, on the organization, so moving to page 9, something that's critically important, I think, for the track record that we've been able to produce is the continuity of the team. Dan and two of the senior partners have been with the organization for north of 16 years, and collectively the investment committee has been together for over 14 years. So there's a lot of stability and continuity within the team. I think it really helps us on the sourcing side, and also from an investment process, it's incredibly efficient. Everybody on the investment committee holds a veto right, so it requires a unanimous vote for anything to be approved. Dan will talk more about the philosophy, and you'll see more of that as we go through the market section. Another thing I think that separates us from a lot of the other firms that we compete with, we are very mindful of the risks that are out there, not only on the real estate side, but other things that impact our investment. So we are constantly looking at trying to identify where the headwinds are, where the tailwinds are, and where we can find unique opportunities. And I think, again, what is unique about our firm, having been focused in commercial real estate debt for almost 20 years, we have very good relationships. And I think that really helps us to find a lot of opportunities that our competitors just don't find. Page 11 is a timeline of the key milestones. There's always a lot of emphasis and focus on things that happened leading into the financial crisis. And I will say that, by no means are we perfect, but we always take the measures that we think are best for our investors. The preservation of capital is always first and foremost on our mind, as mentioned. So the gray boxes on page 11, you'll see some of the measures that we took. We delevered all of our portfolios. We moved away from credit-sensitive investments, and we sold assets. And so with that, you can see our track record on page 12. The four funds on the left are the funds that have been fully realized, and the three funds on the right that are the ones that are partially realized.
And one thing you'll note in here on page 12, which we, in 2006, Mike did not mention, is we were, prior to the credit crunch, we were delevering. We were not perfect. We saw a lot of headwind with how frothy the markets were, and how much the banks were willing to do to aid and abet what happened. And now what we're seeing is how much the government is willing to do to aid and abet, or to cover up what the banks have done, or cover the sins. And cover up is too harsh of an expression, but to cover the sins of the banking system back then. But also back in 2006, we came out with a product which was unique in commercial real estate space, which is to short the market. And you can see it on page 12. The Solomer Fund obviously performed quite well. I can tell you, we haven't gone into the market section yet, but I'll foreshadow it a little bit. We cannot see a way to short this market. The Federal Reserve and the other central banks in the developed world have committed to, quote unquote, do whatever it takes. And what they don't say is whatever it takes to do what. And what they're doing is raising asset prices. And they're going to continue doing that for some time. Our view is, and we can get into that if you'd like, it's probably a longer discussion, our view is they will continue doing that until they can't. And I think that this Federal Reserve Board of Governors and the chairwoman is particularly dovish. We'll move in every time the markets move south, as long as the markets are accommodating. I think I remember pretty well what happened in the 70s the last time this happened. I think that's where we're headed. The real question is when. And I think it'll be some time, frankly.
As in the late 70s?
As in the late 70s, right. It all really started in the early 70s when we came off the gold standard, and they started printing money. Uh-huh. And it really didn't take effect until several years later. And what we're seeing right now is very interesting, is this deleveraging in the private sector among many constituents, and the banks have already delevered. And now what we're seeing is other segments delever, and the government levering up and printing money. in order to cover the price drops. So normally what you would see in a deleveraging environment is that prices would come down. College tuition would come down. But that's not what we're seeing. And the reason we're not seeing it is not because suddenly people can afford more. I think we all know that's not true. It's because they're printing money. And so what they're trying to do is a balancing act. And so we're cognizant of that, and eventually it will come to an end, but we don't see it happening anytime soon. And in the meantime, what's interesting is different segments of the investment world, in our view, are benefiting more than others. And those that are benefiting more are those that are being driven more so by debt coming into the market. If you start to think about leveraged loans in today's papers, there are articles about Credit Suisse being sent a letter by the SEC and the Federal Reserve saying, well, hold on, you guys are lending too much and you don't have the right covenants. You're doing the same old thing again. Mm-hmm. And the question is, can the government really control the banks, or will they just figure out a way to restructure it so it looks less like what rubs the government wrong? That's my guess as to what will happen in the end. They just figure out ways around it. And we'll end up in the same pot of soup that we ended up in 7 years ago.
Then what are the characteristics of what happens when we hit the end?
I think that the red flag that is probably too late is when the bond market starts to back up. I remember that as part of the late 70s, early 80s, there was an ignoring of the bond market. And then everybody found a new religion during the 80s, and what became policy was, in the late 80s really is when it took hold, is that the bond market was more important to watch as regulators than the stock market, because it was a leading indicator. So I think the sort of the short answer to your question is nobody knows what that signal is right before the bond market does, rebels, and rates start to go from 2.5, 2.75 in the 10-year today to 3.5, to 4.5, to 5.5, to 6.5. And when that happens, I think that's a clear signal that they've lost control of prices. But then it's too late.
It's coming.
Which is why we're taking the tack that we are with the capital that you've given us, which is basically, we don't think you can short this market. We feel pretty confident that if we were ready to short it, that we could find the capital to do it, because we were the only ones in the real estate market that did it before. So that's not the reason. It's not that we couldn't attract it. It's you simply, the old adage, you don't fight the Fed. And the answer is that's right 9 out of 10 times. It's that 1 out of 10 times when they can't control it anymore that they lose control. So what's interesting is that there are segments that have benefited greatly, such as very low-rated companies who get loans very cheaply from banks because they're securitizing them and putting them into CLOs. Then there are segments of the investment universe which have not benefited as much, and part of that is the real estate market, interestingly. So the banks, primarily the 14 largest banks in the U.S., have an enormous amount of capital sitting on the sidelines, and it has not been lent out. And the reason is because they haven't told what the next set of stress tests is going to look like. So they sit in fear. And by the way, all of these banks have dozens and dozens of regulators sitting in their offices nowadays. Right? So they're very mindful and very fearful of what might happen or what their opinions might be. And every 6 months or 12 months, they come out with a new stress test. And they have no projection as to what the next set of stress tests are going to look like. And so the banks are not lending into the real estate market. It's very interesting. So the real estate markets have gone up without the debt getting aggressive. So what you can see today is 75% loans on stabilized properties from banks. What we saw in 2007 was 95% loans on speculative properties. So the question is, so why are the prices going up today? Well, they're going up because there's an enormous amount of money out there, and it's flowing into equity. So that is a much more stable position to be in, meaning not levered or not as levered. So when the downturn comes in the corporate space, and we think that'll be first, what we think is going to happen is that the corporate market will go down more than the real estate market because there's a lot more debt in the corporate market. So that's what we think is going to happen. We've sort of gotten ahead of ourselves into that.
What agency does the stress test? Who's the one that develops it?
I'm sorry?
What agency of the government develops the stress test?
That's another issue, which is they all have a few regulators. You have the FDIC, and you have the Federal Reserve, and then you also have the SEC for the public companies. Those are the three big ones, and then some of them also have state regulators that they have to deal with, some very aggressive state regulators, like here in California and in New York. So they're fighting for position as well.
So you're aware that the stress tests are waiting to hear. They're aware of that too. So is there a plan saying that everybody's waiting for it? We're holding back the capital. They come out with a plan saying we're going to give you something in a certain date.
No, there's no plan, and that's part of the problem. They're sort of, I hate to say, they're making it up while they're going along, but they're making it up while they're going along. So. And the truth is, the Federal Reserve is, you know, that's comprised of human beings. They're really very bright, but they've never seen this before. So nobody knows where this goes. And they hope they get it right. They hope they get that balance right, trying to keep prices where they are and or somewhere close to where they are today while the delevering happens. But so, you know, we're taking some pretty important measures with that in mind, while we're taking advantage of the fact that real estate has not attracted debt flows in the way that it did 10 years ago. If you look on page 13, these are the investments that we've made for you. On the left-hand column, you can see the Contra Costa investment number 1, 2, 3, 4, and then an aggregate. And then you've asked us to look at an even-weighted aggregate. If you had given the same account capital and the average would have been $82 million in each account, how it would have performed versus the benchmarks. When we presented to you 2.5 years ago in March 2012, these numbers were very, very different. And so we appreciate the confidence on the back of a pretty bad credit crunch that you gave us then, and I think it's paid off well. And if you can see the difference on page 14, I won't spend a lot of time here, but the column that says Torchlight Debt Opportunity Fund for your investments with us, this is the improvement since the last time we reported numbers to you at that proposal date. When we proposed in March 2012, we were using December 31st numbers, our last quarter numbers, and you can see by example, your first investment with us, which, going back to the previous page, is a 32.5% gross return, was fully liquidated, but we still have a small amount of options in there that pay off once in a while, and so it's gone up 18 basis points. That investment has been written down for 8 years now. So it was a zero, but we get some money once in a while. The second investment, which was long going into the credit crunch, but not levered, so it's as cash has come in, has built back very significantly, has a return right now of negative 2%, is up 900 basis points annualized since we proposed the last fund. And the third investment is up just under 800 basis points. And the fourth investment we were proposing at that time, so there aren't any figures here. If we go now into the market, which I kind of foreshadowed, page 16, our belief is that what happened in 2008 was a credit crunch that drove a liquidity crunch and was solved wholly with liquidity. The credit was really just moved around. That credit that's getting moved around one day will obviously it's being borrowed from the future in effect, and so the banks are so incredibly under leveraged at this point. In fact, to give you some numbers, they have $2.5 trillion in excess reserves sitting at the Federal Reserve waiting to come out and to be used to lend out there. Now, if you put that into context of how big the real estate debt market is, it's only $3.5 trillion. When you add $2.5 trillion, I mean, I'm saying that's only a small number, but when you add another $2.5 trillion into the system, prices go up, obviously. I mean, people, what's really going to happen is the first step is lending is going to get more aggressive as they compete with each other. Once they get comfortable to lever up again. And we haven't seen that yet. What we have seen is the start of investors saying, wait a minute, bankers saying we need to earn more interest margin. And so they're just starting now to get back into the lending game. But we still have not seen any speculative lending at all in the real estate space. Another interesting item that came out in today's paper was here in the Bay Area, Silicon Valley, there are a dozen people on page B5, I think it was, in today's Wall Street Journal. And the journalists asked whether they think it's a frothy market. And they said, well, if 1999 was a 10, we're at an 8 or a 9. But we can't stop investing because we don't know how long this is going to go. And that's really the key. Our contention is that, yes, that's right, on the long side, you want to invest, but stay safe. And so that's what we try to do, as you'll see in a second, and the reasons that we want to do it. On page 17, you can see what the federal debt level has been and the Federal Reserve balance sheet has done. These are historic levels. This is not what the Federal Reserve was set up to do. And so they pushed the envelope on this, and it's going to have some pretty interesting impact. The plan is to move the debt level from today's $16 trillion to $25 trillion in the next 10 years. That's a plan. They always beat the plan, so we can expect that. On page 18, you can also see what the plan is out of the CBO as far as deficits go. So we've seen a reduction in deficits recently with an increase in taxes. Well, of course, if you print a lot of money, tax receipts are going to go up. But the plan is that that's going to increase again, deficits. Now, what is this going to lead to? Well, if you borrow a lot of money and you put it into the system in any way, shape, or form, you're buying things or paying people, whatever you're doing, prices go up. And if you print money, prices go up. If you delever, prices go down. And those are the offsetting forces. It's the reason that we feel it's an important time. We have a conference in the middle of next month, in the middle of October. And we think it's very important timing to have Paul Volcker as our guest there. And the forum we're going to have is, I think, going to be pretty unique. It's a very small venue, and 40 or 50 people. And basically, we're going to have a few hours where we can just ask him questions. All of us and our clients can ask him questions. If there's any way you can make it, you're absolutely welcome to come throw whatever question you like at him. To me, he's the best Fed chairperson in our lifetime. And I think it is very interesting that Bernanke compares himself to him. You know, they both had the toughest jobs, according to Bernanke. Of course, one took the punch bowl away and the other one handed it out. So it's a big difference. You can see what I was saying before in a picture on page 19, which is the lending market has not come back in real estate. And that's a very important element of safety in our minds. And it's also an important element of not being able to devise a strategy that we think would be successful on the short side. You have to be long, and you have to look for as much interest income as you can get without increasing risk too much, because they're not lending. And you can see it in 2013. The amount of loans that were done through the capital markets were $80 billion versus $230 billion in 2007. The numbers are really a stark contrast.
So that's driven by demand versus availability?
I'm sorry?
How much is driven by demand as opposed to how much they're actually available to lend?
It's the demand is enormous for income products, whether it's mutual funds or insurance companies or even pension funds or anything with income that's greater than the what we're being paid in the banks or on treasury rates. And mortgage loans do pay a premium, a 200 to 250 basis point premium. So the demand is very, very strong. The supply is being held back by the fact that the banks are the ones that drive the CMBS market, and they're not willing to take the risk onto their balance sheet. back to the,
make sure there's demand out there, though.
Back to the stress test. Right. That's what's going on. On page 20, you can see a little bit more granularly what we're thinking in terms of where the better place to go is. In the last fund that we invested for you, Debt Opportunity Fund 3, we did quite a bit in the core markets, whether it was San Francisco or New York. And that's the gray line. We actually think that San Francisco and New York are interesting investments because they are significantly cheaper than London, and Hong Kong, and Tokyo, Shanghai. So on an international relative basis, we think they are cheap. But compared to Raleigh or Miami or Salt Lake, you know, we think that those are better investments, especially when lending. And you can see on page 21 what the maturity schedule is going to be like for those loans that are currently outstanding, $1.5 trillion in the next 5 years. So this is the sort of the environment within which we're going to be investing. There'll be maturities, and borrowers will look for partners to give them financing. Our strategy is pretty simple. On page 22, it is sort of block and tackle, frankly. We've done it in the most current fund, we've done a ton of first mortgages. And that's our way of saying you want to be invested where you can gain interest income, but you want to stay safe by staying very senior in the capital structure. So that makes up today just under half of our portfolio. We also are looking for strong controls so that we can step into the place of the borrower in case something goes awry. We don't know when it's going to happen. I don't think anybody knows. But we want to be very comfortable that if a geopolitical event happens and there's a correction, or the bond market does start to back up, which we don't see right now, but we know we don't know, we want to be ready. And we want to be in a less risky position. If you flip to page 4, how are we doing time-wise?
Are there any questions on
A quick question. Your special services division, the $2 billion, that's a service that you provide to other investors or other funds. So the $2 billion is not assets that you have under management, but assets that you're trying to work out for other investors?
It's both. We originally, in 1998, so 16 years ago, we put together a workout group for our clients, meaning we would buy distressed debt. Mm-hmm. And we went through the process of having it approved by Standard & Poor's and Moody's and Fitch. And we did that because you could be the workout agent on commercial mortgage-backed security public bond deals if you got approved by them. So we did that in 1998. And then we bought CMBS for our strategies and had them, that workout group, work on those deals. And insofar as those deals have loans that go awry, they work those out. In addition to that, we don't have third-party clients. So what we don't do is advertise out there, oh, geez, we'd like to work out your loans. We don't do that. But insofar as we're appointed by a CMBS trustee, such as the Bank of New York or any of the other trustees, then we will act as a special servicer for a bond trust. How much time do we have then? I want to make sure we...
You're fine. Don't worry.
Okay. What you see, I'll skip the advertisement on page 24. I'm not very good at that. But page 25 and page 26 are deals that we've done for you and our other clients. On page 25 and in the most recent fund, page 25 is a deal which we did with Freddie Mac where they had aggregated more than $1.5 billion in loans. It was about $1.7 billion in loans, and decided to sell those loans, which is their business, through a bond deal. And we've been working with Freddie Mac for many years, and we're one of the few partners that they'll have. It's a very interesting program because Freddie Mac, being a government organization, tends not to let credit standards slip until, you know, sort of, it all goes. It's binary. And that's what happened in 2005 when they really started getting into Alt-A mortgages. so far, post-credit crunch, they've decided not to let credit standards slip. It's not politically correct to do that. Whereas the investment banks have been more willing to let credit standards slip. So we like doing Freddie Mac deals. In this particular deal, we were able to remove about $150 million in loans. We had a different opinion than Freddie Mac. And you can see by looking at the stats in the center of the page that the average LTV of these loans that were left in the pool was 70%. And so they had an average equity amount in each of the properties of about 30%. On the right, you can see the bond structure. What they ultimately issued were triple A's, single A's, and triple B's into the public bond markets. And we bought the bottom 5% for a 13.2% yield. And so the reason that that has such a higher yield is because any losses on the 87 loans in here would first hit that subordinate piece. Of course, it has to eat through the equity, and being an average of 30%, and they're all multifamily properties. They're all apartment buildings. If you're in the right market in an apartment building, it's a very unusual to have a 30% drop in value. And so there's a significant amount of safety with that equity in there. We like the Freddie Mac deals. We're continuing to do the Freddie Mac deals. They're getting harder to do now. And just as you would expect in a market like this, there are more investors who are wooing Freddie Mac and trying to get into the circle that they've created of buyers. And so we're being, as that happens, we will become more and more careful about doing deals, as we have in the past.
So those bonds, the NR is for not rated?
Not rated, correct.
How does that come about that a bond issue doesn't have a rating? Or they're just, if it's below triple C, we're just not going to bother seeking a rating?
Well, you hit the nail on the head. It's very interesting because they'll issue the bonds. They're not as efficient as the investment banks. So the investment banks would take that and slice it up into a double B, single B, triple C, unrated. So when we buy these, and we've done this almost 10 times, we buy the unrated, and then we take it back to the rating agencies and say, can't we have some double B bonds issued on these? And then we sell the double Bs at a much higher price, and we reduce the basis significantly from what we've done. So many times in the last fund that we've invested for you, we've been able to sell the double Bs for a price higher than we bought the whole unrated. So we've taken all of the capital, we've taken the basis down to zero and actually taken a profit, and we still own, in effect, an option.
So I had a similar question on the NR, and I guess having heard your answer is, who's minding the rating agency store? My scratching the surface in the rearview mirror on the meltdown certainly showed that rating agencies were just heavily involved with a lot of the major investment houses. These tranches that were sliced up and given all of these ratings were simply really rated by the banks, not by the rating agencies. And my question is, has that climate changed? I mean, who's minding that store? Because the process you just described, taking an NR group and then going and saying, can't we get this rated? And getting a nice slice of ratings and then selling it suggests to me that the rating agencies are still screwed up.
There are small changes have been made, but in my opinion, they're not material enough to make a difference to the next downturn. So, by example, what they're careful about are things such as investment banks threw big parties 10 years ago. So what they're careful about are things that are along those lines. But the major conflict that exists in the rating agency industry is so straightforward, and they have not fixed it. So it's pretty disheartening. It's basic. If you're Moody's and you give a harsh rating because you believe through your credit analysis that this does not believe, it deserves a single B rating rather than a single A rating, which is a price difference of 40%. you don't get paid. So you're Moody's, and you say, I've got this opinion of the deal. It's not so good. S&P says, I've got this opinion. They get the money to rate the deal. And Moody's doesn't get to rate the deal. So that major conflict still exists. So eventually, you know, the facade, the decorum, that'll fade. And even if it doesn't fade, it doesn't really matter, because eventually they're economic beings. They're public companies, and they've got to produce earnings. And
they don't get to a point where if you do go to both of them that they have to disclose what both found?
They have to disclose?
In other words, going to Moody's and S&P, and you ask them both the rate, one was here, one was there. Will there ever be a point you have to disclose both of them?
It's an interesting question. I hadn't thought about it. I haven't seen much literature on it from any, really. I can tell you the way that regulated institutions such as insurance companies work, they and banks, they have to allocate a certain amount of capital for different assets, and it varies. So, by example, a AAA bond, the regulators require a lot less capital used up or allocated than a BBB bond. And so they would have to attach their capital requirements to those unused ratings that were stated. So it's not enough to just state it, because that won't influence the insurance companies in this example. They actually have to take the hit, because they have their own opinions of credit. And it's really, it's a capital allocation thing that drives whether they invest in a lower rating or a higher rating. So you need the regulators to change too, with how they.
Yeah, the basis is you've got to get rating agencies to be non-profit or a government.
Or the investors paying for it.
But in your insurance, true, the investors is paying for it in a couple of ways, and they're getting, the bonds are still being overrated, and so the investors are paying for it in losses or foreclosures. But your insurance company situation, the insurance company there's a motivation for the insurance company to have their bond portfolio overrated.
Mm-hmm.
Because then they don't have to allocate as much of their reserves toward it, and they can invest in that reserve, the free reserves and other things. So the whole thing is screwed up. I mean, there's conflicts of interest everywhere as to whether the issuer is paying for it, whether the investor is paying for it, or
you could also take, there's a third possibility, which is to stop the rating requirements for account allocation of capital. Let the insurance company, in our example, invest in what they want to, and if they fail, their stockholders lose money. The policyholders shouldn't lose money. We should have a backup system for that. But so they should be highly motivated to invest in good deals, but anything that requires a rating is going to end up with, as you pointed out, a ton of conflicts.
Mm-hmm. But just know, I mean, that we've sort of been there, done that. Because that, I mean, AIG and other insurers basically were on the other side of the credit default swaps, all that stuff. It goes south, the meltdown occurs, and then essentially the government stepped in and saved AIG, which, saved the market, saved the liquidity in the market. I mean, it seems like a pretty vicious cycle, and the linchpin to a lot of this is the fiction of these ratings. I mean, I'm sitting here listening to this going, it's really unsettling to know that, we can have a rating system that's essentially bought and paid for, and that really hasn't changed, it sounds like. But that's the environment you're dealing in. This is the environment that you operate in.
Right, exactly, and that's why it's so important to have your own credit analysis.
So when you take these non-rated bonds back to one of the rating agencies and say, can't you actually give a rating to one of these? Who's paying that bill?
We do.
Okay.
Right. Yeah. It's the same thing. It's the right. same conflict.
Yeah. Right.
But the reason is because you want a rating to sell it.
Oh, absolutely.
Right.
You can't,
so you're right back to where you started because the insurance companies will buy that double.
Right. Right. I mean, as long as everybody knows what's going on, I guess it's okay.
We've learned nothing from the meltdown. Nothing. Just unbelievable.
Gambling?
Yeah.
In Casablanca?
That's right.
Scary.
Oh, I've got so many movie quotes now. It's going to come out of the repertoire. So, page 26 is a deal that is on the other side of the spectrum, public versus private, so bond versus private. So here's a deal, and we really like deals like this. The picture on the left gives you a nice bird's eye view of what we did. In the blue is the money that we invested for you and our other clients, which is a $54.8 million senior mortgage and a $13.9 million mezz. And the sponsor, the new operator, put in $7.6 million. What's interesting, where the opportunities are coming from in this market, are the inefficiencies of real estate. This isn't the stock market. This isn't the bond market where everybody sees everything. I mean, it's a very fragmented market. Very few people saw this deal. And that's what's interesting to us, is that you can actually play in the, you can invest where others aren't investing because it's so inefficient. In this case, this was a portfolio of four multifamily or apartment buildings, three of which were in the Chicago area, not far from O'Hare, and one was just north of Cincinnati. Very good properties, but they were not very well kept. In fact, the patriarch of the family that had owned these had passed away and had given them to his three children, two sons and a daughter, and the two sons were I guess they were prodigal sons in a way. One was a ski bum and one was hanging out in Cannes at the film festival, and the daughter stayed home and worked, you know, in Chicago and acted as a property manager for these four properties. And as the years went on, she became pretty unhappy with that situation. And so she convinced them that she could be the property manager for these four, and her husband could be the assistant property manager. She was paid $1 million a year, and he was paid $500,000. So shortly after that, that started, the brothers say, well, hold on. And they said, let's just put it up for sale. Now, what she couldn't do was admit to the fact that the property manager could have been hired for $100,000 for these four to take care of these. So there was an immediate expense savings of $1.4 million, just fall right to the bottom line. If you, you know, could buy this at the old expense structure, which we did. In addition to that, because they weren't developers themselves or owner-operators like their father was, they didn't realize that many of these apartments could be converted from two bedrooms into three bedrooms. The two-bedroom apartments were 1,800 square feet. So it was pretty easy to just put up a wall, not a lot of structural work, and call it a three-bedroom and increase revenue. So you could decrease expenses on the property management side, increase revenue. And so what we did is we say, and this is a cookie-cutter deal for us. We've done so many of these. We put a senior mortgage in place until we get that increase in revenue. We put a mezzanine in place until a longer term. But we don't allow the senior mortgage to be refinanced away from us, so we're not, in effect, leveraged on the deal until there's a lot more cash flow going to the mezzanine, until we feel a lot safer about the mezzanine. And in that way, we've met need number one, which is stay as safe as possible. The senior mortgage will have market terms, but we've also, because, as Mike mentioned, we have expertise in the bond market and in the private market, we've kept an option on it to securitize it. So the operator could go in and say, I want to go get a mortgage from Goldman Sachs or JP Morgan, and they're offering me a 5% coupon. We would say, good, we'll match it, 5%, instead of Goldman Sachs or JP Morgan getting 2% or 4% profit, which is what they get today. we keep it for our clients. And in that way, we've increased the revenue to our fund without increasing the risk. And what you're going to see, I think, over the next few years is natural. So we're this vicious circle. What you're going to see is that leverage is going to start to come back. So people are going to take products and lever them. And that's probably okay for a while. And then the music stops. So what you have to be really good at is figuring out when the music's stopping. And we're not so convinced we can do that, and so we're taking this tack instead. In the meantime, the mezzanine has a 15% coupon on it. So the first mortgage is very cheap, but we keep that option on it to bring up the yield on it. The mezzanine has a 15% coupon. And because we did this in partner with the new operator, away from the family, we've kept 10% of the ups for our fund as well. So this is a pretty typical deal.
One of the things that always strikes me about residential or multifamily and deals like this is that it's always pointed as an asset or one of the opportunities and high points or pros is the high occupancy rate. The high occupancy rate never discusses the other side, which is usually that it's low rents, and that's why the people are staying there. And this is a property that hasn't been upgraded in a while. So if you upgrade it, then you have to end up servicing the debt. And so then the people move, if you can get a higher price. So I see high occupancy rate as just one data point. So, and this tells me that the rents are below market.
You have to put it in the context of the market. And you have to say that here we had a whole of the $13.9 million in mezzanine that we invested, we had a whole bank of $4 million. And the $4 million is to improve the properties generally, because they had not been doing that. So modern appliances, countertops, that kind of thing. But you have to do a market analysis to figure out whether those rents can be sustained.
It will support the rate.
And in
increase.
This case, they could be, which could is why we have to do it. But yes, that's exactly right.
And there's been a lack of development. So there is less inventory.
Not that many places to go.
And there are less places to go and less people buying homes. So that's why the multifamily sector continues to be pretty strong.
Okay.
So rent control is the enemy of that strategy?
Many markets have rent control, and we are extremely shy about investing in those markets.
Well, you mentioned New York and San Francisco earlier, and both of those markets have.
I bet you Blue Ash, Ohio doesn't have them.
Blue Ash, Ohio has Procter & Gamble, but not rent control.
But not rent control.
If we go to the next section, it's a synopsis of what we're targeting in Debt Opportunity Fund 5, which is what we're here to propose. Really, if you look at page 29, you can see on the pie chart where we have come out in Debt Opportunity Fund 4 and what our pipeline looks like. And so sitting here today, these are the opportunities as we see them, the best opportunities containing risk and getting as high income as possible. And we believe that the last fund, we could target a 15%+ return. The market has tightened up. We've all seen that with price increases. And now we believe that the right target where we could contain risk is 13%+. And that's just being driven by the market. If you look on the right, what you can see what our base case is and our upside case, and that's what it says is our base case is 13 to 15. There are possibilities that the market, and this is really what the policies coming out of the Fed and the administration are doing, drive prices even higher and higher. And if we are good, we'll sell into that market in a few years and then get a pop similar to what we did in Debt Opportunity Fund number one, and it would be higher in the closer to 20%. The terms are listed on page 30. We are projecting a first close in 2 months, and we're targeting the same capital amount, which is $1 billion. In the meantime, we've been liquidating not the fund that we just finished investing, but the one before that, Debt Opportunity Fund 1. We've returned all capital to you, and plus a little over 20%.
All right.
Fund three.
Yeah, he's the one.
Oh, I said one. Yeah, well, Fund one is also wrapped up.
Yeah. Dan, how much money has been committed to Fund five so far?
This is our first board meeting. We do have a discount for first closers. And so what we do is basically we've lined up the board meetings over the next 6 weeks.
So how many presentations do you have in line coming up?
It's going to be a combination. So we have 300 right now that's circled.
Uh-huh.
And all of them are going through the process. So some of them have consultants, some of them have board meetings, some of them are just simply re-ups. And so we are in the process of scheduling all of that. But in terms of, there are eight investors that all said, we want to make the first close, let us do the work.
So you have approximately eight investors right now who want to make the first close in some way.
And then we have in excess of that. I mean, we have north of 500 of, I would say, define a soft commitment. So people that have told us that they're coming back in, but they're not going to make the first close.
Okay.
So comment. Well, we're doing operators are standing by.
The ones that you've got an indication on so far.
NPS.
NPS is one of was an investor in Fund Four. They were 150, and they said that they're starting to work on their re-up. So. They're the largest.
And the close on this is when again?
A couple months.
When the first close?
Yeah.
We're shooting for middle of November. But it is certainly a game of herding cats. I can tell you that.
You're going to be on the road a while.
Yeah. Hopefully not. I mean, a lot of because of a lot of people have done the work on the front end, so we're hoping that we can do, or some of this will be done remotely. But we're always available to.
Well, you've got a good client list, so a lot of people are probably contacting.
Okay. Well, thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate
thank
it.
You. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you.
Thanks, Dan.
Thanks.
Michael, thank you.
Yeah, thanks for letting me sit down.
Yeah. Right, once he starts, you don't give him much of a chance.
Especially on that topic.
When is the...